field and then
his family descent could be traced directly back to who, fellas? Zadok and Aaron. Okay. How old was he when he was taken captive?
25 years old.
Why did this upset his life? Hear about that, huh? You know what that sounded like up here? Maybe I should ask someone. Why being taken captive at age 25? Why did that upset his life, brother?
Because he was about to go into training for the priesthood.
Okay. The history that is given, not only in Ezekiel, but from circular history, the various dates that he gives, and the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of the king Jehoiakim's captivity. When you go through the whole book and you read the various dates, it helps us to pinpoint. Now, I list all of those down toward the bottom of the page, 1 and 2, 8, 1. The internal evidence of the book helps us to pretty much establish.
You know what I'm saying about when he was afraid of him?
You don't mean he's afraid of
God? Yeah.
This is chapter 1, verse 2, by reading.
Mm-hmm. And so putting the, verse 3, that's the fact that he was a priest. His family is named here in the book. The dates of in circular history as to when these various attacks and things come on the city help us. And these kings he names and the year of the reign, that helps us. It's just a matter of putting all of the dates and times and kings and situations that he names together. And there's not, in other words, what I'm trying to say, there's not one scripture that says he was 25 years old at that time. It's just drawn from all the material that we have. When he was taken and was cut off at that particular time, though he and some of the people may have hoped for an early return, what had Jeremiah already prophesied? That they would be in the land 70 years. Now remember, he's several years younger than Jeremiah. Now, at the age of 30, and like I said, it mentions this, and we'll read across it. At the age of 30, Ezekiel realized that the sin of his people had cut him off from his spiritual heritage. Now, how do you think that would affect you if you realize the sins of your own people had cut you off from the one thing that you had really desired to do? Possibility. And so maybe, every once in a while we say, boy, these prophets really had a lot of guts. Maybe a lot of times some of it might have been a little bit of anger in there too. Maybe it just wasn't all out intestinal fortitude to stand up. They may have been a little bit angry once in a while.
Have you ever looked at it?
Yeah, some that at one time had been very faithful with.
And it really hurts. You think about them all the time.
I have some that I see occasionally on the street, and they'll speak and be just as friendly. They'll even ask about the church. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll be seeing you. And what they mean is, if I bump into you again on the street, I'll be seeing you, because they're not coming to church. And that's the one that really tears you apart, where the... You can think back where a year or 2 years ago they were there, they were teaching classes, and you just wonder what to do with them.
You ever had one that didn't have?
Yeah, I've had a few of those too. But I think even those come along, Brother Jones, for a reason. Remember this, when Jesus sent out the 12, somebody had to go with you. Somebody went with you. So think about that. It's like that saying, you know, that one out of four Americans is crazy, so look at three of your friends. If they're not it, you're the one. So every one of these
four,
every one of these situations, you know, you're it, Mark, so all in favor of Mark? Yeah. Yeah. See? Unanimous.
I thought they said I knew
him
for sure, but
knew you was one, you wanted to do the other, one to do the other crazy one. Okay. One of the things that helped to perhaps soften the blow to Ezekiel was the fact that God revealed to him that he was going to fulfill his priestly duties in the office of a prophet. And he's talking about having people sometimes that you'd rather ship on down the line. I have found one thing in that situation, it always takes two to tango. And generally if there's a conflict between you and the other person, they're generally not always 100% responsible. You have something to do with rubbing the sword. And I found that a lot of prayer, and a lot of times over a period of years, I have found that, not always, but the majority of the time, you just have a little patience, a little prayer, and work at it, those things can be. For an example, when I first went to Porterville, it just seemed like me and one of the deacons there just were not going to get along. Seemed like everything he suggested, I didn't like. Everything I suggested, he didn't like. And it seemed like we were just constantly, you know, like this. And but before I left, he and I got to be the best of friends. And now, if I go through Porterville and I don't stop by his house for a cup of coffee, he acts like he gets his feelings hurt, you know. And every time I'm up in that area, I've been, I haven't pastored there since '68, but I've been back 9 times for the homecoming, and back for 2 revivals. And he thinks now every time I come, I got to stay at his house. So. But it took a couple of years, you know. It wasn't something we just did overnight. So it can't happen. I've got a member right now I've been working on for 4 years, and I finally told my wife, I said, I'm just going to have to turn this one over to the Lord. I'm just not getting through. Something's not right. Either he needs to change or I need to change. And, of course, you know whose side my wife took. She says, yeah, I can see you need some change. I don't live with him. You know, and I said, gee, thanks a lot. You sound like Jeremiah's wife. Traitor, you know. If we're looking for order, logic, chronology, Ezekiel's probably one of the best because of all of the dates. I mean, he tells us when, where, he gives us the kings, the times. A lot of times he gives us the day and the month. So, whereas with Jeremiah, fellas, if we'd have went through that book, and keep that in mind when you read Jeremiah. Jeremiah is not put together chronologically. That book jumps and skips around. One minute he's in the reign of Zedekiah, then he's in the reign of Jehoiakim, and then he jumps back to the reign of Zedekiah. Then he goes back. Well, yeah, and he wrote it also in order of emphasis. In other words, it's like you and I preaching a message. One minute we may be using the Apostle Paul, then we may jump clear back to David or Abraham, then we'll come back to Peter. So he used it as points of emphasis. Whatever sin, whatever, he used illustrations out of, as he, like you say, as he remembered it to get his point across. You know. So it wasn't a chronological thing, but it's a powerful message to deal with the situation. It's a possibility, because you remember the first one was cut up, and then he added two by Baruch. So it's possible that the first one was most likely, because that's the most logical way to write.
Why couldn't they take that Baruch and turn it back
on? Well, you can. It's no problem. In fact, I think I have an outline sheet. In fact, I know I do. I'll look at it next week, and I'll show you where those scriptures break up, and you can put it together chronologically. The way you want to do it. But I think, also, I think on this outline, too, this was not mine. I'm trying to remember where I got this. I think Brother McClung did it, didn't he?
Yeah, sure it was Brother McClung.
But, it does a good job of breaking that down, showing you.
So,
you yeah, all of these names mean something. Huh? Yeah.
Ezekiel means God's
name? We'll see that in a minute, where that name fits what God tells him. Okay? Okay, we were going through, I gave you kind of a little brief outline there of how the book is broke down. The vision of the restored temple. So on page 24 of your outlines now, top of the page, point number 4, the call of Ezekiel. Now you was saying, how do we set the date? Well, it says in the summer of 592 B.C. because it's of the dates and times and everything that he gives here, it's very easy for us to set the, you know, to know when it was. He tells us that it's in a certain year, a certain month of a certain king's reign, and he got these visions and so on. So as a result, it's pretty easy for us to set the date. So in the height of the summer 592 B.C., Ezekiel was transported in a trance. You find 3rd chapter, verse 12 and 15, through there that he was in a trance, captivity at Tel Abib, and dwelt by the river Kabar. And he said, there I sat and remained there astonished among them 7 days. He sat there kind of in a stupor 7 days because of the vision. Now we're going to look at this vision he saw. He saw a great storm cloud being borne down on him. From the north. If you go back to chapter 1, and I looked and beheld a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof as the color of amber, and out of the midst of the fire. Now, as it drew near, he saw that it was the chariot throne of God. Now, fellas, I wish I understood everything I know about this chapter. A lot in here I don't understand. I do not agree with the book, The Chariot of the God, that these are spacemen or anything like that. Don't put your mind to rest right now. I believe that Ezekiel actually got glimpses. Here is one of the theophanies that we're talking about. Now, theophanies is a view or a glimpse of the pre-incarnate Christ. I think Ezekiel here in his call and his commission received some visions that probably you and I will only see when the Lord comes again. But he begins to tell his vision and his call here now in chapter 1, verses 5 through 28. If you've never read and studied this chapter, it's very, very interesting. But I just entitled this The Chariot Throne of God. Now, in this, as he continued to look, he saw emerging from that cloud of flashing fire 4 living creatures who took on form. 1, he saw 4 cherubim. 2, the figure of a man. Now, there were 4 faces to this figure of a man. The face of a man, the face of an ox, the face of an eagle, the face of a lion, and 4 wings, 1 in front, 1 in back, and 1 on each side. Now, that might be hard for us to understand, but here is a living creature, cherubim, has the figure, more or less the overall shape of a man, but he has 4 faces. Okay? Got the face of a man, the ox, the eagle, a lion, got a wing here, wing on each side and wing in the back, the way it describes. The hands of a man under each wing. Now you have four hands in. There was one under each wing. Yeah. Their feet were straight feet, like a animal.
Okay.
The sole of their feet like the sole of a calf's foot. And in the center of this four square of cherubim was a fire representing the glory of the Almighty God flashing forth. Now, notice what he saw, because I think this is something else. Above the chariot of four cherubim was a firmament representing the platform upon which rested the feet of the Almighty himself. Remember when Moses saw God in Exodus 3, the burning bush, he was on a pavement of sapphire. When John sees God in Revelation, he refers to it as being a sea of glass. Ezekiel sees him upon a firmament of crystal here. So the description of God that is given here, and we notice some of the things that I made. And upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness as the appearance of a man above it. Chapter 1, verse 26. He was the color of amber. You know anything about amber? What color is it? Color of amber.
White.
It's a yellowish. It's a hard color to describe, isn't it? John said he was like jasper and sardis with a rainbow about his head. Ezekiel says he's like amber and has a rainbow about his head. From his loins downward was the appearance of fire, and there was brightness round about him. Being the appearance of the likeness of the glory of God, Ezekiel fell upon his face. Now, been a lot of pictures and things drawn depicting this, but one of the things, a lot of questions been asked about these cherubims and these chariots and the whirlwind. Remember, it just moved without turning, went where there was, where the Spirit said to go. The wheels were lifted up over it, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Now, that's why I refer to this as the chariot throne of God, and the way those cherubims were there and their wings didn't have to be any turning, you see, just move. And keep in mind too, we've got a man in his sin, fleshly body, that is doing his best to describe a heavenly vision. And you have several of these two scriptures. Here's Ezekiel, Isaiah. Remember we had that in the book of Isaiah back when Isaiah got his vision of the Lord. And in the sixth chapter, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord sitting upon a throne high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. And above it stood the seraphim, one each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he did fly, and one covered, one cried unto another and said, Holy, holy, holy. So there was his, and he fell down, worshiped. Here's Ezekiel. Daniel saw it, he fainted. John saw it, he fell on his face. And in each one of the descriptions, we learn a little something about God, don't we? One of the things that we learn about God is that he is not inhabited by time and space as we think of it. Another thing that we learn about him is that he does command majesty and authority. The position of the cherubims lifting up show that the angels are in a place of servitude and service to him. The seraphims overhead seems to more or less picture them as guardians over the whole thing. So, like I said, I wish I understood everything I know about this. But remember here, I've never seen God. And Ezekiel here is in a vision receiving a theophany and his call. And trying to relate what he saw must have really been quite a task.
And it looks like he didn't kind of
wait. Remember as a kid, the first time you saw something and you tried to describe it? It's like the, the blind men that they took in. They had never been around an elephant. And one felt his trunk. He thought it was a fire hose. One grabbed a leg. He thought it was a tree. One grabbed his tail. He thought it was a rope. You see? They're all touching the same animal, and I think that's what we get a lot of times in the Gospels and in these various theophanies. We got men from different walks of life. I remember we went to a circus one time, and all my boy talked about was the trapeze act. All my little girl could talk about was the clown. Me, I liked the moon. So you keep that in mind as you view these things. The different people see things differently. Another good example, the first atomic bomb that they exploded. First report, one of the reporters says, "What does it look like?" And the first report that come back was a giant mushroom. Now, most mushrooms I've seen some pretty good size of them. But my goodness. One that would cover a whole town, that's a big mushroom. Well, that bomb explosion since has become known as the mushroom cloud, for lack of a better thing to call it. So, having never seen God, I'm sure that Ezekiel and these others, in many cases, being human, was just no wonder he said, "I sat astonished for 7 days over there." He's probably trying to figure out, boy, just what did I see? How do I explain to people? You got a question?
No, I was just saying, he wasn't positive. He wasn't positive. He had a way of
looking at it. Spirit. Yeah. In the spirit.
For these cherubims, angels?
Yeah, they're part of the powers and principalities of the air that the scripture speaks of. They're part of the angelic host. Well, it didn't have to. If you remember, had four faces, had a wing each way, so it's very easy. They didn't have to turn. They could just, and which way they wanted to move, see? It'd be just like, wouldn't have to turn. Yeah. So, see, it's hard for us to imagine a being like that. I mean, it's hard for me now to imagine a being up here that's, kind of got a man's face out here on one side, and then maybe here on the other side, instead of a man's face, you've got an eagle's beak sticking out, and maybe right at you here, this ox is right here in the middle, then coming at you here, you've got this big ox with his big horns looking at you. And then wing out here, one here and one on the other side. But the overall feature of the thing, they said it was like a man. I've never seen a creature like that. And if I saw one coming down the street, I'd probably take off.
Cartoon style.
Yeah. Heavens, the Murgatroyd, and what is it? Well, so I don't know. When we get to heaven, we'll probably see things that we hadn't even imagined, Brother Moore, that were there. I don't know. I've read some big description as to what these things represented, and that each face meant that, and it meant this and meant that, and they were representative of this and that. I think we need to be careful about jumping off into those things. I mean, some of them sound good, and the guy's going to big, long, lengthy definition. But I'm more inclined to believe myself. You can agree with me or disagree, that's your privilege, but I'm more inclined to believe that's what the man saw. It's what he said he saw. And I find that's a lot easier in prophecy, in Ezekiel, and even when you get on into Revelation. I think that's the trouble in the study of prophecy, is that a great part of the time is that we do throw too much spiritualizing, and we want to, well, that's what he said, but this has got to mean this and mean that. Why can't it just mean what it says? I find that's a whole lot easier. I've got this one book at home. This guy's something else. I don't know what denomination he is, but it's a commentary on Daniel and Revelation, and he gets over there where he talks about a third of the trees being burned up and all of that, and, well, burning represents one thing, trees represent something else. I don't think so. I think he means just that. A third of the trees is going to be burned up. See, so I think that this is what Ezekiel saw. He calls them heavenly beings. I've never seen any heavenly beings. So it'd be hard for me to describe them as well. But as he goes into chapter 2 now he sees this appearance, and he said, I saw it, I fell upon my face, and I heard a voice of one that spake. One that speaking, sitting there, he said unto me, Son of man, stand upon thy feet, and I will speak unto thee. God needs men that'll do what? Stand on their own two feet. Get up, Ezekiel. Good sermon right here in Ezekiel's call. Yeah, it's a good one right here. On Ezekiel's call. Good message in here. And the Spirit entered into me. Lord needs Spirit-filled men that stand on their own two feet. See how this thing unfolds? When he spake unto me, and set me upon my feet. We need to realize, even though we stand on our own two feet, we need the Lord to establish us in the right standing, a place to stand, that I heard him that spake unto me. We need men that will listen to him. And he said, said unto me, Son of man, I send thee. We need God sent men. Children of Israel, the rebellious nation that hath rebelled against me, they and their fathers have transgressed against me unto this very day. Notice how he describes these. They are rebellious. He says they are briars, they are thorns, they are thistles, they are as scorpions. And God promised him now on all of this. He said, whether they will hear, or they will forbear for their rebellious house, ye shall know that there has been a prophet among them. You get that statement in verse 5? There yet shall know that there has been a prophet among them. You know, boy, there's a good statement. Do people know when you leave their presence that there's been a Baptist preacher among them? They know there's been a child of the king there? Or if you went back and told them, they'd say, huh, that's a Baptist preacher. You're a Christian? Yeah, that's true. But notice what he says here. Son of man, don't be afraid of them. Be afraid of their words. So briars and thorns be with thee. Thou dwell among scorpions. Be not afraid of their words, nor dismayed at their looks. Oh, and there's been times if looks could kill, I've been dead several times. Though they be a rebellious house, now notice, and thou shalt speak my words unto them, whether they will hear, and whether they will forbear, they are most rebellious. That's right. And God told him, said, boy, they a hard-headed bunch. Yeah. He said, I made thy face strong against their face, their forehead strong against your forehead. We're going to jump ahead now to chapter 3, verse 8. But he says, against their foreheads as an adamant, harder than flint have I made thy forehead. In other words, Ezekiel, you're going to get out there, you're going to have to butt heads. sometimes. You don't find that. That's not a pleasant part of pastoral work, but a lot of times you do that. You run into people of the world that are rebellious and steeped in their sins. You don't butt heads, so to speak. It's a hard-headed bunch. So Ezekiel gives a symbolic description of receiving God's word there. But thou, son of man, hear what I say unto thee. Be not thou rebellious like the rebellious house. Open thy mouth and eat that I give thee. And when I looked, behold, an hand was sent unto me, and lo, a roll of a book was therein. Now this is very similar to some things we find in Revelation. Remember in Revelation 10:11, where John, the angel, another mighty angel, comes with the little book that's standing on the land and the sea, and he gives the book to John. He eats it, and at first it's sweet to his taste, but when it gets into his stomach and he begins to digest, it becomes bitter. And so we have close similarity here. And he spread it before me, and it was written within and without, and there was written therein lamentation and mourning and woe. Now, what's the difference between a lamentation, a mourning, and a woe? Get the definition of these words right here.
Well,
what's a lamentation? What kind of crying out?
Lament. Like
what?
The women in the group were lament over the servant. I mean that they would be in, like, you know, way mourning, way.
A lamentation is one, brother, that's pulling at your heart, right? When you're lamenting over something, it's something that has disturbed you, not only physically, but spiritually. Mourning.
Mourning.
When do you generally mourn over death? What's a woe? And that's something I know you fellas, that something more than what you tell your horse at the end of the ride, isn't it? That's right. A woe was always a warning that calamity and destruction and judgment was on its way. So this book then was written with these things. So we can see perhaps, I'm thankful that we have God's complete book that goes beyond the lamentation, the mourning, and the woe. Joy cometh in the morning.
You know, it seems to me that these were all steps in my first reading of this.
Don't know which way to turn. Perilous time. Moreover, he said unto me, son of man, eat that thou findest. Eat this roll and go speak to the house of Israel. To open my mouth, and he caused me to eat the roll. Then to me, son of man, cause thy belly to eat, and fill thy bowels, or their inner being, is what he's talking about, with this roll that I give thee. Then did I eat it, and it was in my mouth as honey for sweetness. You beat me to the question. That's just what I was going to ask you. He said literally. In other words, did the Lord hand him a scroll like this that was written in paper and said, open your mouth, Ezekiel, and most likely a skin. A part of
the outward body, the American sense is inward body.
Uh-huh.
So, you think it's spiritually?
Jesus said, taste of me and see that I am good. You want us to become cannibals? Except you eat of my flesh, drink of my blood. What are you talking about? He that drinketh this water shall never thirst. I am that bread of life which cometh down to heaven.
What are you talking about? These things are spirits. Do you think that he was maybe like John? You know, John on the olive pavement out there, and you know, many people picture it like that.
No, not hardly. That's a fact. Right.
And he was out there, and these people were torturing him. And when he sees the revelation and sees what God's going to do, he thinks, he says, get him, Lord. And then right at the end, you know, you know, maybe what he's doing here, maybe he was ready. He says, before these people are calling me, this is your sin that called me to anoint the Lord and free. Get him, Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And then after he saw what was happening,
he back off.
Yeah.
It's a possibility. I think that was definitely John's situation. First of all, John says, get him. And then when he realizes that the getting is, most of it's falling on Israel and his people, that, as he begins to digest the word. You see, as I begin to read the word, I think it's glorious as we read, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. But when we get to chapter 3, it breaks your heart. But as you keep on reading, it's great thing to discover that God took care of it. See, you don't have to get past 3 chapters in the book to find out that God's the creator, he made us, that we failed him, and that God stood by us and redeemed us through the blood. And I think that you just about hit the nail right on the head right there. I think you talked about a spiritual consumption. As we read it, and as he read it, and he realized what was going to unfold, at first he's really excited. Boy, these people caused me grief, their sins, and now I don't get to serve as a priest. I'm ready. Boy, let's go get them. Let's sock it to them. And then when he realized what was going to happen, the time that they were going to be in captivity, and I think also in Ezekiel here, he realizes a time of interval in here before his people are going to be restored, and it becomes this. Take it easy. Don't kill him, Lord. He's finally seen it. Yeah, I've had that happen a few times. Well, one of the Old Testament books that we studied, you remember Edom, when Israel was down, stood on the mountains and cheered. That's what the word actually means. They actually cheered the Assyrians and the Babylonians. Yeah, get old Jacob. And every chance they'd get, they'd run in there and pillage and rob. And then when the people try to escape to the south, they'd cut off the escape routes and plunder the pilgrims that were trying to get out of the land. So God let them have it from them.
One other book, Brother Ralph, was that the prophet called for the judgment of God upon Israel. And then when Israel started judging them, he started begging God. The Lord did that too much.
Well, Moses did that on several occasions. You remember when he was leading them out? Remember on one occasion the people, they wanted a new leader and was going to kill Moses. And the Lord intervened. Moses and Aaron intervened. Remember, he told Aaron to go get some fire off the altar and said he stood between the living and the dead. Then a few chapters later, you find Moses telling God, go ahead and kill him, Lord. Go ahead and kill him. And then when the plague starts, you find Moses again. Wait a minute, Lord, not all of them. You know. So we find that situation going back and forth several times in
Moses.
And Amos. Amos, where he cries out, and it's where he begins to see the plagues is there in chapters 7 and 8. And those things start unfolding. And he cried every time until the Lord hung out the plumb line. He pleaded back with the Lord every time.
He didn't believe what happened to him.
Yeah.
I want to go back to
Jesus. Well, the message was written on the scroll, the book. He's told to take it, eat it. It was sweet to his mouth. So the prophet then was ordered to proceed on to Tel Aviv, not far from the river Kabar. And here was a colony of Jews. And so for 7 days, he just sat there astonished. And I think that's something, just sat there for 7 days. You know, just because look at the traumatic experience the man has just had. Weak. Has anything ever hit you so hard you just sat there? You just couldn't. And somebody say, ask you back there, just couldn't believe my eyes. Saw it, but can't believe it, you know. I've had a few experiences like that. Have you ever saw that something happen? You get all excited and you, did you see that? Boy, did you see that? I don't believe it. And you just thought, I don't believe it. So Ezekiel here is in that astonished for 7 days. Here's a good sermon here in these next verses. This can be tied in also with this, you might say, a renewed call or renewed push and ambition along this line is found on over in the book of Ezekiel also. And he covers some of the same material in chapter 33. So there's a close parallel between chapter 3 and chapter 33 as far as the watchman is concerned and the individual responsibility. Now we remember that he sets him here as a watchman, okay? In Ezekiel 3, he makes him the watchman over the house of Israel. When you get to chapter 33, he makes each individual responsible before God as being a watchman. So we get the responsibility of the prophet, chapter 3. Chapter 33, he spreads the idea of the watchman to all the people. So you said you'd make sermons so you can spread that thing out. Not only is the pastor responsible, but all of God's children are responsible for sounding the battle cry. So, son of man, he said, I've made thee a watchman. Now, okay, we'll have to discuss that watchman next week. I was going to ask you to give me some good definitions of a watchman, but describes much of what is going on in the temple area. He describes the idolatry of the priesthood as he's seated. Remember, God brings him back and transports him in the spirit. And not only, you know, he had several sad notes in his life. The one being taken captive when he was. Another one is, as he viewed over the city, he saw the Spirit of God actually leave the temple. So, they shall know me as Lord. They have not for years acknowledged me as Lord. They have not served me as Lord. But they're going to. It's just like right now, there's a lot of people that don't believe. They don't believe. It's hard for historians to deny that there was a Jesus Christ. And most of the world accepts that there was a historical figure named Jesus. Okay? But the difference is they do not acknowledge him as Lord, just like the Jews. Even today, they believe there was a man named Jesus, but they don't accept him as the Messiah. But there is coming a time, according to the book of Zechariah, they shall look upon him whom they have feared. They're going to know he is Lord. And I think Ezekiel emphasizes that very strongly because he sees the destruction of the temple. He sees the spirit leave it. He's not allowed to use his own priesthood, but then he sums up his book with the new temple, and he sees the Spirit of God coming back into that. So I think that phrase is very fitting.
He said that after the battle of Armageddon, after this battle, after everything, all of it, instead they will know that I am their Lord.
Right. How does the Lord come back in Revelation 19? King of kings and what? That's when every eye is going to see.
So you think
that's when Israel will be born.
Talking about their salvation then?
As far as the nation. I'm not going to say that everyone in Israel that sees the Lord, that not everyone that sees him that day is going to necessarily be saved. But Israel's going to be reborn as a nation. God's saving Israel because of his covenant with Abraham. Well, that's hard to say, Brother Johnson. There's a difference of opinion. Physically, he could have been sitting right on the river, and the Lord could have transported his spirit right back to the city, or he could have gave him a vision right there. Either way, to me, doesn't do harm to the power of God. You know, the fact is, he said he was transported in the spirit, which seems to imply to me that he was here and... Mm-hmm. Which is not impossible with God.